Now you can ask me any question you want.
First of all, about Jack Levy.
Jack Levy, I wrote
to you. I have been very much interested in Jack Levy.
Yes.
And in future, I want to write about him.
Let me tell you that Jacques, I call him Jacques Cohn, but his real name was Jacques Levy, and Kafka mentions his name in his diary. He was a real man, and this man had hundreds of letters of Kafka with him.
Hundreds
of letters, because he was an actor, and he came to play in Prague in 1911. And he became a friend of Kafka, a real friend of Kafka. And Kafka corresponded with him. He used to carry all these letters with him. And in those times, this was in the beginning of the 30s or maybe in the late 20s, I didn't know yet about Kafka. And I used to say, who is this Kafka? And Mr. Levy used to say to me, one day you will know who Kafka is. He's going to be a famous man. And so it happened. And he himself, Jacques Levy, was a most interesting person. He was very similar to the way I describe it. Yes.
I think so.
Yeah.
But according to Max Brod,
yes,
Levy depended on Kafka, not only financially, but also spiritually. However, apart from financial problem, Levy was a kind of senior for Kafka, just like you wrote in your short story.
Yeah.
What was the real story?
What did you say? He was a kind of what? Senior?
Senior. According to Max Brod.
Yes.
On the contrary, Levy depended on Kafka.
Not Kafka, but Levy.
I feel.
Yes.
From the description of diary,
yeah,
and also in your story.
Yes.
On the contrary, Kafka depended on Levy.
Well, it is hard to say who depended really on whom. We don't know. I would say financially, Kafka might have given something to Levy, because Levy was a very poor man, a poor actor. I don't know really if Levy ever took money from Kafka or not. He never spoke about money altogether. My impression was that he admired Kafka greatly. He was a great admiration. He was actually kind of in love with Kafka. And there was a woman who used to come to the Writers' Club in Warsaw. Her name was Čižik. She was an actress.
Čižik.
And this woman, really, Kafka was in love with her. For a short time, Kafka was in love with this. Of course, when I met her, she was not young anymore. She didn't look as well as she did most probably in 1911. But the whole thing that Kafka was in love with this woman made an impression on those who knew Kafka. I didn't know Kafka, but I heard already about him, and I knew that he was a famous man. Maybe even I began to read, before I left Warsaw, some The Castle or The Murder of Kafka's work. I really learned more about Kafka in this country, in the United States, since I came here in 1935.
How did he live in Warsaw?
He lived in great poverty. But in the same time, he dressed like a dandy, always was dressed, you know, he had this ambition. You know, an actor has to be elegant one way or another. He wore a monocle, you know, like one glass in his eye. He really behaved in a strange way, you know. He was similar to the way I describe him. And for him, this meeting with Kafka was a great event. It's always a case that when people meet a great man, even though the meeting might be an accident or something else, somehow it becomes a topic or a theme in their life. And this is what really happened to Jacques Levy. To a degree, his, whenever we, you began to speak to him, the name of Kafka came out one way or another.
According one of your translator,
yes,
Evelyn T. Beck.
Beck, yes.
Yeah. Wandering in Europe, or in everywhere, from Warsaw to Prague and Paris, Vienna,
yes,
Leipzig and Budapest. And afterwards he came back to Warsaw.
Yes, he played. He played in many theaters in German. Jacques Levy knew the German language. Not all Yiddish actors knew German, but he knew German, and he played with. I think even he played with Reinhardt for a short time.
It's really.
Yeah. And in those times when an actor played with Reinhardt, even if he had a small part, this was for him a big event. So of course we in Warsaw looked at him as an actor from the big world, you know.
And I suppose Levy may have met a lot of eminent people in those days,
yes,
including Reinhardt.
Yes.
He mentions the name of such people, another person.
Like Jakob Wassermann,
yeah.
Arthur Schnitzler. He mentioned, he was what they call in this country a name dropper. He liked to mention big names. Uh-huh. Whether he met them all or whether he just met them, he saw them, it was hard to know. But he always said, when I met Stefan Zweig, when I met Jakob Wassermann, when I met Arthur Schnitzler, Peter Altenberg, he was always proud that he met the famous European writers, but we never met any one of them. Although when I was a boy, and I was already older than a boy, I met Goldsworthy, the English writer. And this was an unusual thing, because Goldsworthy came to Warsaw, I think, to a meeting of the Pen Club. And he came to the Writers Club. I could not speak English, but I greeted him, you know, and he greeted me. And people said, this young man writes novels. And it was for me a big event to meet a famous writer like Goldsworthy. Of course, he was much older than I, and he was famous. Was a small man, not tall, a very charming kind of a person.
I have a copy, a Xerox copy of Jack Levy from the Yiddish lexicon.
Really?
I cannot read it.
Yeah. This is he when he was young.
Oh,
This is he when he was
he
young.
Really
he was, I can tell you, he was born September the 10th, 1887 in Warsaw, Poland. His parents were poor Hasidim, and until he became bar mitzvah, until he became 13 years old, he was brought up by his grandfather. And together with his grandfather, he went to a Hasidic rabbi, and there he was singing. He was kind of a singer. He had a good voice. He helped sing in the synagogue. His Jacques Levy's uncle used to act as an amateur on Purim, and the holiday of Purim, in his father's house, also on rabbinical weddings. About his first steps on the stage, Levy says so. In those times, I had already, when I was still very young, I had a great desire for the theater. And as a boy of 17 years or 19 years, I said goodbye to the yeshiva and to the books which I studied there. And I went and I ran away to Paris. And I knew Paris from the famous book of Sue, The Mysteries of Paris. I found there a number of comrades, young people from Warsaw, who believed very much in my artistic abilities. because even while I was in Warsaw, I used to go without the knowledge of my parents to the Polish theater. So when I went to Paris, I went there to meet them and also, of course, to see the French theater. And so on and so on.
Thank you.
You can have, I mean, it's a large article, but you don't want me to translate all of it.
Thank you.
Yeah, but it would be necessary if you write about Jacques Levy to have a translation of this whole business. Maybe you will get that someone.
I may be
fine. Someone who knows Yiddish. And in the worst case, if you don't find, come to me and I will translate it for you.
Thank you. And what do you think about Levy as a writer? He was also a writer.
I would tell you, he wasn't too much of a writer, not a good writer. He used to write articles, memoirs, but he was a helpless writer. He could write, but so they always sent back his articles, you know, whatever. Anyhow, all I know, I didn't read much of him. All I know is that he had great trouble in publishing an article or two, but he needed it because he made a living more or less from this. So whenever he managed to publish an article in the Yiddish press, he considered it a miracle, you know. He was a man in trouble in every way. He couldn't act anymore. He was too old for acting. Also, there was no place for him in the theater. There was no place for him in the press. There was no place for him in the whole world. But he was a sweet man just the same. And I see now from the photograph that when he was young, he was quite a good-looking man. He was even good looking in his old age. He looked kind of very dignified, you know.
Debonair.
Huh?
Debonair.
Yeah.
Did you see his performance in the stage?
I never saw him on the stage. I don't remember ever seeing him. Because in Warsaw, even if he did play something, they gave him a small part, let's say a man who comes in and speaks three words and leaves. So because even if I might have seen him for a moment, I have no recollection really of how he played. I'm sure he might have been a good actor because he was also in a way an actor in life, you know. He was acting always. Acting was his second nature, I would say.
But as a writer, he had not so much good talent.
I don't think so. He was not really a writer. He was a journalist. Mm-hmm. And he always wrote memoirs about his going to Prague in 1911, meeting Kafka. In other words, when he spoke about Kafka, he wrote about Kafka, he got letters from Kafka. In a way, he lived with Kafka, although Kafka was already dead in those years when I met him. When I met Jacques Levy. Uh-huh. If someone would ever have told me that a Japanese scholar would be interested in Jacques Levy, I would consider it so far-fetched, so remote, so impossible. But life has ways of bringing together things which look impossible.
Next question, as for the Yiddish theater.
Yes.
Yeah. You wrote Yiddish plays and wrote about the Yiddish theater in New York.
Yes.
We cannot expect a reverse of the Yiddish theater in future because now the Yiddish city...
I will tell you, from a logical point of view, there is no hope to the Yiddish theater, there is no hope to the Yiddish press. There is no hope to Yiddish literature.
Right.
This is from a logical point of view, but in the history of the Jews, the history of the Jews and logic are two different things. According to the logic, we should have gone under 2,000 years ago. Already 2,000 years ago, or even 3,000 years ago, our situation was terrible. But somehow we managed to live, or as the English call it, muddle through. We just sneaked by, we muddled. And the same thing may be with the Yiddish theater. If this is possible, that in 1977, a Japanese, a man from Japan, a scholar from Japan, comes here to speak about the Yiddish theater and Jacques Levy, this shows that we are some kind of an eternal people. Whenever people think that we are already dead, we are still alive. So because of this, I am not completely pessimistic. I wouldn't be surprised if 100 years from now there would be a Yiddish theater right here at Broadway and people would go to see it.
How's the situation of the Yiddish theater in those days when you came here?
Oh, when I came here, the Yiddish theater was still very much alive. But it was on the way down, but still very much alive. In Warsaw, and the same thing here. When I came here, they played my brother's play, Yoshe Kalb, which was a famous play, and the brothers Ashkenazi, and they played him in Paris. On my way to America, I stopped over in Paris, and there I went to the theater to see a play by my brother. In other words, they played them in Warsaw, they played them in Paris, they played them here, and they played other writers. In 1935, it was very much alive. Of course, they worried about the future, but it was alive. The famous actor Morris Schwartz was then alive, and he was directing. He was a man of great energy. I don't know if his talent was great, but his energy certainly was great. Since then, things went down and down and down and down. But just the same, a few weeks ago, a man called me on the telephone. He would like a play. He would like to play something if I could give him a play. In other words, the Yiddish theater is still not dead. And in our situation is so, like a man who is very sick, if he can still breathe, if he's not dead, this is already something.
You saw the Yiddish theater in also Warsaw and at the same time in New York.
I saw it in Warsaw and in New York.
Yeah.
What was the difference,
yes.
You would say? I would tell you. In Warsaw, they did not try to adjust themselves. They did not try. They played. If they played a Jewish play, it was a Jewish play. Here, they tried to imitate a little bit Broadway. They always tried to make it a la Broadway. And because of this, there was a strange element. And when they finally played here, The Fiddler on the Roof, it was more Broadway than Sholem Aleichem. When I went to see it, I saw it was a great success. It was even a great success in Japan. But it was a small part of it was Sholem Aleichem, and a great part of it was Broadway. They applied all the tricks of Broadway. So because of this, the Yiddish theater here, although it had great successes, from a point of view of quality, it wasn't the best.
I was very surprised. Among the Yiddish theaters in those days, there are various kinds of Yiddish theater. From mere melodrama to the social aware theaters and various kinds of Yiddish theater.
Because Jewish people here in this country, although this country has only two parties, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, but the Jews had maybe 20 parties, and every party had tried to have its own culture, its own little theater. So they had many theaters, but actually none of them really made big money. They all made little money. They were an expression of the fact that we have, let's say, Zionist and labor Zionist and socialist and leftists, people who were more to the left than the socialist, and then communist and Trotskyite, and every one of them tried to have a little theater. So they played in various halls, but it never amounted to anything big.
My question is may repeat.
Yes.
Judging by the appearance, the Yiddish theater becoming disappeared.
Yes.
But the spirit of the Yiddish theater is immortal, I think.
Yes.
But in what point the Yiddish theater, the spirit of the Yiddish theater is immortal, do you think?
I will tell you that it would be wishful thinking, but I hope so. For example, for years and years, the Yiddish theater imitated Broadway. Now, Broadway is imitating, in a way, the Yiddish theater. We were influenced by Broadway, but now I see that Broadway was influenced by Second Avenue, by the Yiddish theater. In
Could
other
you tell
words,
me the Hindi tale about it?
For example, A Fiddler on the Roof is half Broadway, half Second Avenue, you know, and a number of other plays. What was interesting about the Yiddish theater is it had many faults, it had many defects, but it had one great quality: it was never boring. Somehow, they never had these kinds of boring plays which you can find here sometimes in the English theater and the American theater, a play where things are stagnant, nothing moves. Somehow, our audiences were so that you could not give them any boring stuff. If you would have given a boring play in Yiddish, the people would have left after the first act. So you always had to give them, even if you had a drama, you have to make it a little melodramatic, so to keep the audience. And now they do the same thing very much so on Broadway. In other words, there was, I would say, a mutual influence. For years they influenced us, now although we are half dead, we are influenced them.
It's very interesting.
Yes, yes.
We can find such phenomena of the influence of the Yiddish theater on the American culture.
Yes.
Also in literature.
Yes, the same thing. You know that now a number of you, as you see, they keep on publishing books about the Yiddish theater. And you ask yourself, why should Americans be interested in the Yiddish theater? Because the Yiddish theater has influenced the American theater. And I will tell you more. Yiddish literature is influencing, in a way, American literature.
Yes.
Let's say they translate me, and many young writers read me. And I wouldn't say I have a great influence, but I have some influence. And so influence is always goes both sides.
Yeah.
If I influence you, you influence me.
Several times ago, I discussed with a Ben Bonas, actor,
yes,
the Hebrew Actors Union,
yeah,
about the physical element of the Yiddish theater, mime and exaggerations. And
so, yes.
Yeah. Can I suppose some of the essence of the Yiddish theater is such a physical element?
There is always a physical element. Theater is not all spirit. It is made of physical things. It's hard, as I think that Mr. Ben Bonas could explain it better than I did, because he knows more about decorations and so on. What was characteristic about the Yiddish theater in the later years was that we didn't have young actors anymore. So when we needed an actress to play a young girl, we took often a woman of 50 years and she played the young girl. If we didn't get a woman of 50, we might have taken a woman of 55. But this never happens in the English theater, or seldom. They have the young people. On the other hand, sometimes an older woman is so talented that she plays a young girl better than the young girl herself, you know. The situation of the Yiddish theater was so that they had to do many things which the others didn't have to do. I saw it in Argentina, in Buenos Aires, was a large Yiddish theater. It still exists. And there it was very much similar to the Yiddish theater in Warsaw, and a little similar to the Yiddish theater of Broadway. Also, actors are travelers. They came from New York to play in Warsaw. And they came from Warsaw to play in New York. And they came from New York and Warsaw to play in Buenos Aires. So it's kind of an international business. I have now a novel called Shosha, which will come out in the future. And there I describe an American actress coming to Warsaw to play in before the Hitler time. I think that this has already clicked. Oh, yeah. It's still here.
Yes. That's very interesting. And, Next question about your letter.
Well, is this working or it's not working?
Working.
It's working, yeah.
It's all right?
Yeah.
because sometimes my ear is deaf.
No, I heard it click for a moment. Look if it's really working.
You want to check?
Are you sure it's working?
Okay, all right. Expect human.
I will tell me, is this also active? This
yes,
is,
yes.
Come over here. I want you to be. To
I
sit.
Have one more film.
One more film?
Yes.
Good.
He has another.
Yeah.
All right. Each film lasts 1 minute.
3 minutes.
Three minutes.
Yes. I see.
And about your literature.
About my own work.
In your story, exactly to say, in the essence of your story, the narrative element is most important, I think. It is also the essence of Yiddish literature, the narrative moment.
I wouldn't say that it is, in a way it is true, but it's not 100% true. In my case, it is very much true. I came to the conclusion years ago that if literature loses the story, the narrative, it loses its main function. Because literature was born as a story. You told stories and then you wrote stories. The modern writer has neglected the narrative element. He doesn't tell a story anymore. He dabbles in sociology, psychology. The net result is that people are not anymore eager to read a book, because In real literature, the great masters of the 19th century, they told the story so that the reader wanted to know what happens next. When you read Balzac or Dickens or Dostoevsky, there was great tension. Nowadays, writers feel that tension is not important, the story is not important. The main thing is the message which the writer has. And I don't agree with it. I think that once literature is losing the power of telling a story, it is losing itself. So I, in my own way, have decided, no matter what the fashion is, I'm going to remain a storyteller, as writers used to be in the 19th century. And I'm not afraid that they will think that I'm obsolete, I'm dated, because there are certain truths which are always true. They have been true in the 19th century, and they may be true in the 19th century.
Are you such nature of the narrative, emphasizing the narrative nature? It can be connected with the Yiddish folklore tradition?
To a degree, yes. Because, of course, folklore is all storytelling.
Yeah.
And this is true not only with Yiddish folklore, it's true with Japanese folklore, with all folklore. Folklore tells a story. When anything which is connected with folklore is not preaching, it always tells you a story. Something has happened, then he may try to find some conclusions of the story, but the story is there. And since I think that literature should be deeply connected with folklore, it should never really divorce itself of folklore. So in my case, I'm both a storyteller and I try to be as connected with folklore as possible in the way the story is. Not in every story you can use folklore, but as much as I can, I use it. And again, this is also something which has been lost in modern literature. The modern writer has in a way decided that folklore is not something for him. He has outgrown folklore. I don't feel that way. To me, folklore is still very much alive.
But for you, the Yiddish tradition is folk tradition rather than the mystic and Hasidic and such legalistic traditions.
I would say I make a use of everything in Jewish tradition which is important for the story. I will not write a story just to bring out tradition. If the tradition has no place in it, I will not use it. But if it has a place, I will be happy to make use of it. Because if literature must have an address, it must be connected with a people, with a way of life. Without it, it becomes only a kind of a temporary. It doesn't live long. There are books today which are well written, but they have no address, they have no roots. And since people began, now I hear that people begin to look for their roots all over the world. But I was always looking for roots, even before this was the fashion.
In my translation of A Friend of Kafka,
yes,
I was trying to translate it by the narrative Japanese.
Yes.
And some leader prized me. We, for the first time, read the singer's literature.
Yes.
Yeah. It's not wrong to translate your works by the narrative language.
Yes, you can say so, that this is how it should be translated. Uh-huh. In the style of a narrative, in the style of a story. I guess in Japanese, the storytelling has a different kind of style. You have a different kind of
of
language,
yeah,
which is wonderful.
How do you tell a story in Japanese?
He says in Japan, it seems that the Japanese, a storytelling has a different kind of style.
Yeah, what is their style?
Well, listen, you cannot ask. If you don't know Japanese, he cannot explain it to you. But I understand that it is so. In other words, the Japanese language is so that you use for some occasions a different kind of language. Not completely so, but variations.
So then you'll influence Japanese.
Well, I don't intend. Whatever happens, all I can say is, whatever happens, happens. They may influence me too.
In Japanese, the written language and narrative language are completely different.
Do you hear this?
Yeah.
Yes. This is wonderful.
It is written. Very completely different.
Completely different. Yeah, I understood from your question that it is so. In that case, I like to be translated into the narrative language.
Also, in your story, we meet a lot of fools or a person like a clown, and also a person just like a fool. Kimball and this is also the point you have been emphasizing.
No, I am not emphasizing it always, but once in a while I do. Uh-huh. I mean, it is in the tradition of Yiddish that there was sacred fools, but this is not only true in Yiddish, it's true in other languages. For example, the German writer Hauptmann has a book called Der Narr in Christo. It means the fool in Christ. There were always holy fools. And I think you may even find this tradition in Japan or even in China, where the fool was kind of a prophet in a way. I make use of it, but it's not the essence of my writing. But since I'm connected with folklore, I make use also of this part of folklore.
That was a Jewish tradition.
Yes. Just the same, I'm not a traditional writer. I mean, I don't write according to tradition. I also have created my own style and my own tradition.
But through the Jewish tradition.
Yes.
And you create the new.
Yes, of course, of course, of course, because this is the address.
Yeah. But usually, sometimes present contemporary author is apt to forget such tradition.
Yes,
We have already forget.
Tradition. The modern writer tries to move away from the tradition.
Yeah.
He says this is old-fashioned. They have the, and to me nothing is old-fashioned, because yesterday to me the yesterdays are part. If we cannot understand today, if we don't know the yesterday. If we would know the history of humanity from the beginning, we would understand many things which we don't understand today. And since literature is something which wants to make certain events permanent, we should never look down on tradition. Once we begin to look down on tradition and folklore, we are doing great damage to writing. Do you know that I read, for example, the Japanese book, Kenji, what was the, this, the book of Kenji. I was interested in a book, it was written in the 11th century, and although I didn't understand everything, but I was fascinated by the fact that the book is there.
Among your stories, there are several types, I think. For example, the story in the Polish scene.
Yes.
And the story in New York.
Yes. Sometimes in Israel.
Yeah, and so on. There are. And how we should classify your story, if I can?
I will tell you that some people call me an American writer, which is true because I have written almost all my books in this country.
Yeah.
Some call me a Yiddish writer because I write in Yiddish, and some call me a Polish writer because I write most about Poland. I would say that in my Yiddish language, I am, in a way, an American writer, a Jewish writer, a Yiddish writer, and also a Polish writer. Many Poles... I was this week in Harvard University, and they brought me a magazine with a Polish magazine, which comes out now in Poland with a story of mine. They are beginning now to translate me behind the Iron Curtain. I don't know, for a long time I was taboo. They never wanted to translate me, because I'm against communism. I'm not a communist. But lately they have become, in a way, more tolerant towards me. And I foresee that in sooner or later they will translate me into Russian and Polish, because I describe actually Polish life. It is Jewish Polish life, but still Polish life. I'm also a member here of the Polish Institutes of Arts and Letters in America. They made me a member. They consider me their writer, one of their writers.
And if so, I can, how many types of your literature I can count?
I will tell you what I write always about Polish Jewish people speaking Yiddish. Sometimes whether they are in Poland or they are here or they are Israel, but these are the same people. I never write about other people. I would never write about Russian people or English people or Italian people. In other words, I write about the same people in many places, because these people have been immigrating all the time. Well, they went from Warsaw to Paris and to New York. But when I write about them, it's always the same people.
Uh-huh.
Only in rare occasions I will mention, let's say, an Englishman or an American born here. Only as a side show, but he's never the real topic.
Uh-huh. It's a basic point.
Yeah, he's not. Yeah,
it's very interesting.
Yeah, he's never the real. Have you eaten breakfast? Tell me, Deborah. You have? I don't think so. I think you are fasting. No.
One more, two or three questions.
Okay, fine.
I think you mentioned your English translation is the final version of your text.
Yes.
Could you tell me about
it? I will tell you.
Yeah, in detail.
Of course, I write everything in Yiddish. But when it is translated into English, this becomes the original for all the other translators, because no one in Japan knows Yiddish, or in Italy, even, or in England. Since I know that the English is the language from which they translate me, I work very much on the English translation. Sometimes I will add to the English translation things, or I will crossword things. In other words, I do a lot of editing in English. So because of this, I'm actually, although I'm a Yiddish writer, I would say I'm also already a writer in the English language, because it's important for me, because of all the translations being from the English. I see to it that not much is lost in the English translation, and if I feel it is lost, I will do enough editing to fill in what is missing.
Yeah. Yes. I'm afraid the English language lacks kind of dynamics of the Yiddish theater.
The Yiddish language, yeah.
Sometimes light and mimic nature of the Yiddish language.
Of course, it's a great problem.
Yeah.
The English is a precise language, but it doesn't have these exaggerations and these phrases and these idioms which Yiddish has. But on the other hand, English itself is a very rich language. And if you try hard and you do a lot of research, you can find a way out. Of course, every translation is a compromise. You compromise by translating from one language to the other. But just the same, we know that the Bible has been translated into 1,000 languages, and everybody enjoys it, which means if you have something to say, it will come out in all languages.
Finally, could you tell me about your life when you were involved in the daily
here?
Forward. Yeah, here.
In the forward.
Because many people in Japan do not about
know about the Jewish. Yeah. I will tell you, there is here a Yiddish newspaper called the Jewish Daily Forward. It used to be on East Broadway, but now they moved there now. On 33rd Street, and the old building was taken over by Chinese people, believe it or not, by the Chinese, because it's near to Chinatown.
Uh-huh.
Where the forwards used to be is now it's a Chinese club.
Uh-huh.
In other words, as you can see, this is a place where addresses change. But still, this newspaper comes out every.
Yeah.
And I'm going to show you a copy of the Jewish Daily Forward. You stay here, I will bring it up.
He has every week.
Still now.
Every year, even
yeah.
So today.
Here is a copy of the Jewish Daily Forward. And I publish in here, yeah, it is not, it is Hebrew letters.
Yeah.
And Yiddish language.
Uh-huh.
And I publish in this magazine. Every week you find something which I has published.
It's
forwards. Yes.
Forward. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Just like,
yeah. Yeah, I see you can read Yiddish.
I'm trying to
read
the Hebrew
language. Yeah, yeah. Here is my story here.
Oh.
It's called Yarme and Keile. And here is my name, Yitzhak Bashevis Singer.
Uh-huh. Your story, most of your stories were for the first time published in the Forward.
Yes, they still are, most of them. Once in a while I publish in another magazine, but I still publish most of my works in the Forwards, in Yiddish first.
Uh-huh.
And after I read it in the Forwards and I edit it, then I begin the English translation.
Uh-huh. When you came here, you came as a editor of
No, I was not. When I came here, I was a freelancer in the Forward,
uh-huh.
And I worked for 6 or 7 years,
uh-huh.
And later I became a member of the staff, I mean a regular.
Uh-huh.
But it's already about
40 years.
It's not yet 40 years. I became a regular in 44. It's about 36 years that I'm a regular, or 37 years that I'm a regular member of the staff. But even before I became a member of the staff, I worked for them a number of years, 4 or 5 years. In other words, I'm connected with them over 40 years. And I would say I worked there as a journalist and also as a writer. I published the articles about all kinds of topics. At the same time, I wrote stories and novels. Now I publish only fiction. I don't work there as a journalist anymore. Only once in a while I will publish an article, but very seldom.
Also as a staff?
Yes.
You do not work as a journalist?
Not anymore. I used to. Not anymore. Everything I write, I send it by mail, and they publish it. Sometimes they make mistakes, which I correct. You know how it is. Would you like to photograph the forward in this?
Yeah. Thank you very much. Very interesting.
It was
interview.
I will tell you, I invite you and my secretary to come down with me, and let's have a little bite, a little lunch outside.
Thank you.
Yes.